This is NPR News. I'm Marianne Combs. Do you remember the movie Her from a few years back? It's a film about a man who falls in love with his voice-activated operating system.
You talk to anyone else while we're talking?
Yes.
Are you talking to anyone else right now? Any other people or OSs or anything?
Yeah.
How many others?
8,316.
Are you in love with anyone else?
What makes you ask that?
I don't know. Are you?
I've been trying to figure out how to talk to you about this.
How many others?
641.
What?
That was Joaquin Phoenix as Theodore and the breathy Scarlett Johansson as Samantha, a futuristic version of Siri or Cortana or Alexa. Now, while Samantha is still the stuff of designer dreams, in recent years, voice-activated operating systems and personal assistants have taken off, promising to seamlessly provide hands-free control of your life. They play your favorite music, do your shopping, regulate your home's heating and cooling. Rather quickly, they have insinuated themselves into our homes and our everyday lives. So, do they make our lives better? What are we giving up in the process? And how are they changing our own behavior and relationships? Joining me by phone from Chicago is Ben Sauer. He's a digital product designer and strategist at Clear Left. Ben, thanks so much for joining us this hour.
Hello. Yes. Nice to be with you.
And joining us from Cleveland is cyborg anthropologist Amber Case. That is the coolest job title ever. Amber studies the relationship between humans and technology. Amber, thanks so much for joining us this hour.
Thanks. It's great to be here.
So first to you, Ben, do these programs that we're talking about, Amazon Echo or Alexa, as it's known, Cortana, Siri, do these all fall under the heading of artificial intelligence?
That's an interesting question. I guess artificial intelligence is being used particularly well to recognize the words that we say. So, you know, amongst regional accents. And so on. And then the goal is to have them interpret, artificial intelligence should interpret what we are saying, much in the way a human would. So there's a few stages of how the artificial intelligence is being used. And the first stage of just recognizing, you know, what we are actually saying is the really interesting area that has kicked off a lot of the recent innovation. But yes, the intelligence to sort of act like a human, as you mentioned in the movie Her, that's a dream at the moment.
Yes. So it seems like there's recently been a lot of investment put into the development of better voice recognition, better networking. Are we on the cusp of some great shift here in terms of our relationship with these voice-activated programs?
Yes. I mean, I think we are going to see them all over homes. That's growing quite steadily. I guess there's a few sort of goals that people have in mind here. I mean, the first is to make computers work the way that humans work instead of us having to work the way that computers want to make us work. And so voice is probably the most natural way for us to do that. I guess the other thing is just making tasks simpler and quicker. If you count the number of steps that you have to take using a screen, often it's some quite complicated business to do simple things like, you know, play your favorite radio station, and kind of just asking for it makes that much more convenient. And I suppose one of the other goals is to give us our attention back. That's one of the other things that voice systems are doing really well. You know, I'm sure lots of your listeners are struggling with kind of, I know I am, my addiction to my smartphone, right? It's, it's a distracting device. And what voice allows us to do is to kind of push computing into the background. So it's all around us. We can summon it when we want to, but it's not necessarily in our faces and not necessarily distracting us all the time.
Amber Case, why are these programs so appealing to us? Ben mentioned the convenience aspect, but what else do we get out of them?
Sure. Well, the idea is that we're overwhelmed by all this technology and that our attention is pretty fractured and fragmented. If you think of somebody simply trying to make something in the kitchen, for instance, and let's say their hands are messy and they really want to listen to something or add an item to their grocery list or get a recipe, it's kind of nice just to be able to use their voice in order to get that done. But there were actually a lot of people who were researching this before technology was so embedded into our lives, notably Mark Weiser and John Seely Brown at Xerox PARC that gave us the modern graphic user interface and a lot of the technologies that we use today. And what they said in a paper called The World Is Not a Desktop is that that we need to have technology that requires the smallest possible amount of our attention, and that the scarcest resource is not going to be technology in the future. It's going to be our mental capacity. How much can we pay attention to or not? And so when we have all of these things around us requiring our attention all of the time, having something that makes use of a different sense other than just your visual sense or just your hands is something that's really useful to people, and people have found really nice. Not all of the time, but in some of these situations, it's really useful.
That seems so different than the way we behave with our smartphones today. We constantly have a phone in our hand and are looking at screens of one sort or another. So is this something where you see a lot of movement going on right now, that there is this shift away from the handheld device, that the idea of people running into each other as they're looking at their phones is going to be a thing of the past because they're going to be looking forward and looking up at each other and actually communicating with each other instead of their devices?
I think we'll see people trying to get away from that. But again, we're going to have kind of an unevenly distributed future where some people will be the types of people that will be addicted to things normally are just going to find another interface to be addicted to. And that's going to stay the same. But what there's been a lot of interest in, at least over the past 20 years on and off, has been kind of this concept of a calm technology, where technology should inform you but also not take you out of your primary task. So if you look at driving a car, your primary attention is on the world around you. Your secondary attention is either to the wheel or to the dashboard. Your tertiary attention is through the feeling of the pedal on your foot. And so you're actually able to use much, the high resolution of your primary sense to look at things and calculate things. The secondary sense of touch and the tertiary sense of feeling to pay attention to the other things and make decisions. And you're actually using two or three channels of communication there. But then when you switch over to your phone, it actually dumps all the variables that you've been storing in your head, from your primary attention and just takes it all into your phone. And that's why it's so dangerous to use your phone while you're driving, because it just drops you out, and then you're stuck in one channel when you're supposed to be in the other channel. So it's interesting because you have these kind of different senses, and a lot of these technologies, especially for the phone, have been just relying on our primary, the idea of the visual sense. And there are so many other senses that we can make use of, and so much peripheral attention that we can make use of, that we can do great things. But I think a lot of defaults are, we need to have a visual display. We need to have this little control panel that shows you this, and we need to have everything light up and be in full color. It's like, well, what can you do with a simple light? On a Roomba, if it needs your help when it gets stuck and it goes dun-dun, and when it's done cleaning, it goes dun-da-da-da, right? You don't have to translate that into tons of different languages. Even if you're red-green colorblind, there's an icon that shows you whether it needs help or not, and it's red or green. I mean, just those tiny lights can tell you more than a whole control panel could. And so a lot of people, hopefully, they're going to realize, hopefully by people buying their products or not, that less is more, but it's very difficult to engineer something with less because our default is to make more. We think technology is great if we have more of it. But in reality, if we look at the things that have lasted for many, many years, the things that people end up buying, mid-century modern furniture and appliances, it's because they were designed so well that it's difficult for them to break because there's less pieces. It's logical to use. A lot of it's actually tactile. And so that's kind of what we're seeing, is that this good design can really help out, and really bad thrown together design can just make your life a lot worse and break on you all of the time. If mm-hmm. you've ever been stuck in a parking lot trying to get out because your ticket got bent and it didn't work, and it's just a robotic attendant, you know, that in that case, when things get automated, the most important thing becomes customer service.
We're talking this hour about voice-activated programs like Siri and Alexa. If you use one, and if you have a smartphone, chances are you do. What do you think of it? Does it make life better for you? Are you wary of such devices? If so, why? Give us a call with your question, your comment, your experience. 651-227-6000 is our number in the metro area. That's 651-227-6000. Or you can reach us toll-free at 1-800-242-2828. That's 1-800-242-2828. Online, you can reach us at nprnews.org/live. Ben Sauer, we were talking a little bit earlier about artificial intelligence and how it's used in these devices. How intelligent exactly are these devices?
The truth is that they're not as intelligent yet as those companies would like us to believe they are.
Mm-hmm.
There's a metaphor we use in kind of designing for voice, which is most of them are like a gopher. They perform simple tasks for you, you know, like listen to a radio station or set a cooking timer. They're fairly simple transactional things that you do with them. They're kind of one-off things. We don't really know how close we are to be having conversations with computers like you saw in that movie Her, or really ones where computers truly understand the meaning of what we're saying. We're seeing some progress in that area, but it remains unclear as to when we will be feeling like we are truly conversing with another human.
What are you most excited by in the field of artificial intelligence and the integration of these sorts of software into your home?
I suppose it's more of the, the people end of things, I suppose. Like, there is an emergent field called affective computing. So that's when computers can detect our mood and perhaps respond to us in different ways based on how we're feeling. Being able to identify us. So some of the voice-activated systems that are becoming very prevalent are not actually able to distinguish different people in the home. So that could be a very interesting thing. And I mean, there is a lot of progress being made in the conversational space. So Google, for example, Google's Home, which is their competitor to the Amazon Echo, is actually much better than the Amazon Echo at sort of continuing a conversation where it understands the context of something you said before. So, you know, who's the president, for example, and then, what year was he elected? So understanding that the second question is connected to the first question.
Mm-hmm.
Those are the sorts of things that we are seeing some progress in. But to be honest, the intelligence tends to be quite narrow. That's one of the issues with artificial intelligence at the moment, is that you can ask it a question, but you don't really know whether it will have broad intelligence. At the moment, we don't have broad intelligence, effectively. You have to kind of know that it will be smart at certain things you ask it, but not at others.
Hmm. You know, there is, of course, a business side of this. And when we buy into these devices, my understanding is that we're actually buying into a corporation along with all of its business partners. The system you buy is going to determine, in some cases, your search results. Is that correct, Ben?
Yes, absolutely. So we're kind of making a deal with some of these companies that is, I suppose, fairly new in human history, in the sense that we buy something and it brings great value to us. So the convenience of having a voice assistant in your home. But then there's something else. The business value is generated in another way. So in Amazon's case, they would like us to, you know, order our shopping or our gifts through the voice interface, and sort of that's where they win. Or, you know, as I'm sure everyone's aware, that now these companies are targeting advertising towards us based on the information that they learn about us. And in fact, voice interfaces are perhaps a little bit more intrusive in this sense, because they only work by sending the data to the cloud, to some computers that company owns. These voice interfaces don't tend to work in an isolated fashion on our devices only. They have to work by sending the data elsewhere. That's how they learn, that's how they get better, and that's how they actually recognize what we are saying. So, yeah, we're starting a new kind of relationship with these companies at the moment.
We're talking this hour about programs like Amazon Echo, Google Home, devices that are supposed to make your lives easier. Give us a call with your question or comment, your thoughts on how you use the device, whether you like these sorts of tools or if you are wary about bringing them into your home. You can reach us in the metro area at 651-227-6000. Let's go to the phones. We've got Margaret on the line in Minneapolis. Margaret, welcome.
Hello. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure thing. What's your question?
So my question is, obviously there are some outliers to this trend, like Waze, for instance, using voices like C-3PO and Shaquille O'Neal for advertising purposes. But my question is, why are most of these systems utilizing female voices over male voices?
Great question, Margaret. Amber, do you want to take this on?
Sure. Yes, it is an interesting question. I mean, in some cases, it could be a difficult question to answer properly, and there's probably needs to be more research about why. In some cases, it's nicer to hear instead of like a really low rumbly voice. It possibly might, thinking about it in terms of like hearing it over other voices or other background noises, a slightly higher pitched voice might be easier to hear over other things. People have chosen this voice often because they like hearing something like this. But, you know, it's kind of like once you get a voice of a computer in a film, I mean, a lot of this early on, if you think about like Metropolis or Rossum's Robots or any of these really early, you know, human machine films, there had to be this like, it was like person versus machine, humanity versus machine. So you had to have these like machines that showed up as actors. And the issue with that is that's where we got the idea of robots from. It's like these films kind of influence our reality. And so if we started hearing female voices in things like Star Trek, which was like the wife of Gene Roddenberry's voice, or some of these other places, or you had French science fiction that kind of predated her, that had people falling in love with their machines, or you had people naming their ships, you know, after females, then you end up getting this trend where people think it's the norm to do this sort of thing. Or like if you look at directory assistance and early voice concatenation or Siri, often people just kind of default to this because they've just seen it so many times. And so, and in some cases in navigation, you can choose a different voice, but this is something that you kind of see over time as a trend, and it continues to happen. And then because everybody sees that that's the trend, they make the business decision that, oh, this is how it is. This is what we've seen. This is what people are used to. And then they continue it on. And I think that's probably one of the major reasons, and I'm sure there's a bunch of other reasons behind that.
As an anthropologist, I'm kind of surprised you didn't go into looking at gender roles.
Well, that gets complicated.
You don't want to go there? You think that that's maybe a little bit too dangerous territory?
I think it warrants more investigation and probably more than an hour radio show to talk about that sort of thing, because there's the secondary thing of, one, people are used to this. Two, people like the idea that, you know, there's been a lot of history where females have been doing things like, hey, help me out, or there's been secretaries, and that's the second one, right? And
right.
So that's another reason why, and then there are more reasons why. But yes, so I think there are a bunch of factors. One of them is the roles that people have been used to with secretaries in the past and assistants, which have traditionally been female. Second, we've seen it in films a lot because that's, you know, the computer is female, right? And there's other things, but yeah, and the weird thing is that what I've seen is a lot of people just keep it that way. They don't change it around. You know what I have seen is, though, some people have changed the voice, like in their car navigation, to like an Australian male because they really like that accent. So there are some accents, for instance, and there are some voices that people feel is music to their ears and they really like to listen to it. So that's a good question, and it is important to think about.
Let's go back to the phones. We've got Elizabeth on the line. Elizabeth, welcome to the conversation.
Hello.
Hi. You wanted to chime in here?
Well, you just touched on what I called about, and I was wondering when we're going to get a choice of a wonderful, calming tenor voice named John.
Ah, nice. So, oh, you even have a good name picked out for him, I see. So,
it's a good name.
Yeah. So you feel that we're lacking because we don't have a male voice to choose from?
Well, I would not say lacking ever. I'm a pretty easygoing person, so I think the whole thing is awesome. I like Siri's voice. Mm-hmm. I like the whole concept, and I am much older than most people who do this stuff, so I think there's a lot of room for it. But I also think there is something very calming about a tenor voice also, and it just as we kind of gender role the secretary thing that you just said,
mm-hmm.
there's also the sage wiseness of a strong male voice. And I just think it would be fun to have a choice.
All right. Thanks for your call. Ben, do you want to weigh in on this at all? Why we have more female voices than male out there?
Yes, I guess one of the interesting questions for me is whether we, if these systems become ubiquitous and we have them everywhere, is whether we're perpetuating that stereotype through this technology of, mm-hmm. Equating, females with assistants. And certainly it's something when my kids use these things, I start to worry about what their expectations are in future. But I want to kind of give one argument as to why some of these companies will stick to a default, if you like, which is that they want to create some sort of consistency. So Amazon wants us to relate to Alexa. They may not want us to change the gender of the voice, because they want everybody to expect the same thing when they use Alexa. So I think that's one of the reasons why some of these systems are not, able for us to make that choice, even though we might want to. So I think it's kind of effectively a branding exercise. They want it to be the same whenever anybody uses it. But I have a lot of sympathy for the argument that they should be customizable and that we should have more flexible gender roles, definitely.
We're talking this hour about voice-activated programs like Siri, Alexa, Google Home, and how they change our lives, our relationships to technology, our relationships with each other and businesses. We'd love to hear from you. I'd like to sort of switch the conversation as we move forward to talk a little bit about personal privacy and security issues. If you have concerns about what your Alexa device or Siri is hearing, what it's doing with that information, do you have concerns about your personal security or privacy because of these companies, or are you fine with it because it's a reasonable expectation to turn over that information in order to get the convenience of a device? Give us a call with your question or comment at 651-227-6000. That's 651-227-6000. You can also reach us toll-free at 1-800-242-2828. That's 1-800-242-2828, and online at nprnews.org/live. We'll return to this conversation and take more of your calls after a break for news headlines with Stephen Zhang. Good morning, Stephen.
Hi, Marianne. One of the more controversial of Donald Trump's cabinet nominees has won committee approval. The Education Committee today approved the nomination of Betsy DeVos to be Education Secretary after a clash by Republican and Democratic senators over the nomination. Democrat Patty Murray charged that DeVos has spent her family's wealth to push extreme anti-student ideology. Senate Finance Committee votes to confirm President Trump's picks for the Health and Treasury Secretaries are being indefinitely postponed after Democrats boycotted the meeting. Minority Party senators say they are demanding more information about the two nominees, Georgia Congressman Tom Price to be Health Secretary and financier Steve Mnuchin to head the Treasury Department. The Democrats cited separate newspaper reports about Price's trading in a health company stock and Mnuchin's behavior involving foreclosures when he was a banker. Finance Committee Chairman Orrin Hatch accused Democrats of posturing. The leaders of Germany and Sweden are denouncing the immigration restrictions imposed by President Trump. Both say they're seeking more clarity on how their citizens will be affected. Meanwhile, the decision by the British government to invite President Trump for a state visit is stirring controversy. An online petition opposing the visit has drawn now more than 1.6 million signatures, prompting what will be a non-binding debate in Parliament set for next month. A healthy demand for homes and a shrinking supply are again driving up home prices. The Standard & Poor's CoreLogic Case-Shiller 20 City Home Index finds that prices rose 5.3% in November. That's up slightly from October's gain. This is Minnesota Public Radio News at 11:35.
Later on All Things Considered, students who sued Globe University and the Minnesota School of Business won in court, but this grad says it doesn't matter.
And I found out that my dreams were just gone.
I'm Tom Cran. That story and all the news, join me starting at 3.
Coming up at noon, why did it take so long to solve the Jacob Wetterling kidnapping? We'll have part two of the radio special In the Dark from APM Reports. It explores how law enforcement dealt with the overwhelming number of leads in the Wetterling case. That's at noon.
Programming is supported by the Women's Foundation of Minnesota. Together with Bank of America, they seek to drive gender equity and provide economic opportunity for women and girls throughout Minnesota. More at WFMN.org, Bank of America, N.A., member FDIC.
You're listening to NPR News. I'm Marianne Combs, and this hour we're talking about voice-activated programs like Siri, Amazon's Echo, and Google Home, and what it is, exactly it is, how these are devices are coming into our homes, changing our way of doing things around the house, and gathering information in the process, and changing the way we live. And we're taking your calls, whether you think this is a good thing or you're a little wary about how this is changing your life, or if you think it's been become a completely great addition to your life. We'd love to hear from you. You can join us at 651-227-6000. That's 651-227-6000, or toll free at 1-800-242-2828. That's 1-800-242-2828. My guests this hour are Ben Sauer. He's a digital product designer and strategist at ClearLeft, and Amber Case, who has the great title of being a cyborg anthropologist. Amber, when we look at the way we behave, does our interaction with technology reveal something about ourselves and our own nature?
Sure. I think we've co-evolved with technology since we started writing on cave walls and since we had fires. And so really it changes us and we change it. And when I was writing my thesis, I was walking around San Francisco looking at people using their phones. People would put their dog on pause to send a text message because they couldn't walk and text at the same time. And from my perspective, because I held back on getting a smartphone just so I could observe people better, it looked like everybody was just tapping on these little glass interfaces and getting really distracted. And I think it's about that primary attention, that your primary attention can go into the world or it can go into the tiny phone. And the weird thing is that through the Industrial Revolution, we kind of had this stretchiness of reality where we started to have all these highways and airports and these places that weren't really places. You could think of a place as something where you have identity and relation and history to other people. And suddenly a lot of your life ends up being in these non-places where you don't have any identity or relation or history to anybody else. So how do you reconnect and have an experience of being in a place again? Well, it turns out that being on your phone gives you a kind of guaranteed social experience where you are connected to people and you do have a relation and you do have a history on that device. And so in a way, these devices kind of give us a coping mechanism to this kind of non-place weird reality around us in which it's all these strangers and all these different places that we're encountering, plus the amount of information that we have to deal with on a daily basis where it's, I need to go to this address and I need to have this meeting and I need to talk to this new person and then I need to answer this message, is no longer you're getting physical mail on your, you know, on your desk at work or in your mailbox once a day. At any moment, you could get interrupted from many different people who are all in their own kind of time zones. I kind of call this simultaneous time where everybody's having all these different communications and that can interrupt your physical reality at any moment with a ping. And so it becomes this juggling act where not only are you kind of having this persistent paleontology in your email account, trying to find the information that you need as more and more information keeps piling on top of it, you're getting interrupted at the same time, yet you're also in this place that you're kind of put on pause, you know, in a kind of industrial space like an airport or a shopping mall or something. And it becomes okay to just sink into your phone. It becomes a more compelling place than the world around you. And that's kind of what I'm seeing people do and what I've been seeing people do over time. I mean, I myself am addicted to my phone. What's not to be addicted to? The whole business model of the phone is to addict yourself to it because it's based on ads. You need to get shocked and dismayed and excited like every 2 seconds so you can look at an ad and an advertiser can pay that network so that they can keep running.
Are you at all troubled by the fact that you have this addiction to this phone that is giving you all these ads?
Well, on the one hand, it's making it so much easier for me to do things that I would normally not be able to do because I'd have to do everything in person otherwise. And on the other hand, it keeps me up at night. The blue glare of the screen actually inhibits melatonin production, which is mm-hmm. what gets secreted in your brain when to make you sleepy, right? And so you end up having this kind of like fragmented mental brain system when you wake up in the morning. And it's not great. On the other hand, it's, you know, there's kind of equal benefits and equal deficits. I do put my phone on airplane mode and say I'm not using this for the day and do something on paper. And if I need to make a speech or, you know, write a section for a book, I do it on paper first because there's a difference in how you think. I think the problem that I see mainly is when the web was quite new, or at least we had desktop computers, you would work with your desktop in the same place. You wouldn't have your head crunched over, so you had like more blood flow to your brain, and you would be able to think for a while because you didn't have all this stuff coming in at you. Or when the web was new, you were creating on it more than you consumed. And now with these phones, they're a lot of times mostly consumption devices. You're not creating on them as much. Mm-hmm. And so we end up consuming more than we create, which can lead to things like anxiety and depression and addiction, simply because we're not interacting with the computer as a tool. We're consuming from the computer. And that means that, you know, we're waking up with our phones and going to sleep with our phones. Even, you know, you see people in relationships and the first thing they do in the morning is they don't look at each other. They look at their phone. And then 15 minutes later, after they've absorbed all the news, then they hang out with each other. And then there's some crisis that happens in their email. So it's kind of this thing that comes in between people in a way, because there's just so much distraction and it's just so compelling. Because there's all these things going on all the time, and they're specifically formulated to get your emotions excited, even though it's not really there next to you. It's not in your room. I encourage people to try and put their phone in airplane mode and see what happens.
You know, you mentioned earlier about being on pause when you're in a waiting room or something. And one thing I've noticed is how airports have changed. They used to have those TVs blasting in the waiting area so that everybody could hear the news on the television. And now they are much quieter because everybody's sitting with their own personal device and is on doing their own thing. And suddenly the airport has sort of transformed into this much quieter environment. Amber, you wanted to follow up on that?
Sure. I think the idea of a quieter environment is going to become more and more important. I'm actually writing this book on sound design and how to make things that don't annoy people, because now we have all these beeps and boops and other environments. Now people, if you see the people on planes that really know what they're doing, they get those noise-canceling headphones and they just sit there in this pod of either silence where they're blocking out the world or some music where they're listening to their own media instead of somebody else's. And we're seeing that kind of cocooning happen so that people can block out this really annoying environment that's not of their own choosing.
Let's go back to the phones. We've got Sean on the line in Woodbury. Sean, welcome to the program.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure thing. What's up?
Yeah, I wanted to chime in on the security element of the Alexa or Google Home. It's a very, I think, interesting phenomenon, right? Because we're on our tablets, we're on our laptops all day long, and you often see people with Band-Aids or a piece of tape over the video camera, right? And yet we carry our smartphones with us every single day.
Mm-hmm.
So I really feel if there's a security issue with the home automation devices like Alexa and whatnot, we shouldn't be carrying our phones, right? Because that is... If the camera can be activated or the voice can be activated, and without getting into conspiracy theories, I really don't see much of a security.
Okay. Sean, thanks so much for your call. Ben Sauer, what are your thoughts on this? Are there valid security concerns about having a smartphone with you every day that has both a camera in it and is listening because it's voice activated?
Yes, absolutely. In fact, there was a picture taken recently of Mark Zuckerberg in his office, and everyone noticed that the camera on his laptop had been taped over. So I think it's kind of ironic that somebody in his position would be protecting his privacy in that way, given the sorts of things that his business is working on.
Mm-hmm.
I think, as I mentioned before, we're entering into an era where we have a different relationship with these companies. And in fact, it has been proposed that surveillance is not going away. It is just going to happen. I'm thinking of Kevin Kelly, the former editor of Wired magazine. And he proposed
I think that's worth restating what you just said there, that security and surveillance is not going away. It's just going to happen. That's a very strong statement.
I'm not sure I subscribe to that completely myself, but that is the argument about technology itself. It records, it sends. That is kind of its default mode. I guess to think about our relationship to these devices and these companies, it has been proposed that what we need is a model of what's called covalence, where actually it's much more transparent about what is being sent and what is being shared. And in fact, if anybody owns the Amazon Echo and they want to explore the app, you will see it can actually play back every single recording of your voices at home that it's ever made, which at first is very creepy, but then you start to think, well, actually, they're being very transparent about it. And I think that is kind of the idea, that we will have transparency, and that would be the ideal. Now, of course, what's happening on these devices is completely invisible to us. What happens in the digital world is ephemeral. So whether it is really transparent, whether we are really getting security and privacy, is another matter entirely.
And it does make sense. I mean, when we think about technology, in order to be more effective at what they do, these devices have to learn about our behavior, which means storing information, processing it. But again, that information can be accessed by companies. And I know some companies have said, look, after 6 months, we delete this, and after, or, the name it's associated with, and then after 18 months, we delete the audio or the information entirely. But it does raise questions about whether a conversation that's overheard by Alexa or Google Home could be used, say, in a divorce court proceeding, because it overheard and recorded an argument.
Yes, absolutely. And I think there are some legal cases where perhaps the police have tried to subpoena Amazon, perhaps. I'm not sure of the details. I have heard about cases where they tried to find out what the recordings were in somebody's home related to a crime. So I think we are going to see a lot more of this happening. And we're going to have to figure out a very different relationship to each other and these companies.
I should note that Mary wrote to us and said, I disconnected Siri. She became too intrusive. She was listening to everything I do. I know other people have said, it responds to me when I'm not talking to it. And I believe this is also something was noted in a situation with Alexa, where a child told Alexa she wanted a dollhouse and it went and bought her a dollhouse. So there are issues with, these devices taking commands or interpreting things at commands when they're not necessarily meant to be.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, anyone who's got an Amazon Alexa will know that you can trip it quite easily. It happens quite often in my home. I guess what we're seeing is probably the early days of this technology. And in fact, one of the reasons that they send all their data to, this central place, the cloud, where it can be interpreted and used, is that by doing that, these companies can get better at filtering the noise or recognizing what we are saying or whether a command was an accident. In fact, that's one of the things that the artificial intelligence is really improving at the moment, is actually sort of filtering out, what somebody is really trying to do from these sort of accidental quirks. So at the moment, we can't actually get the sort of benefits of better performance and hearing us and listening to us more effectively without us sending all the data to the company. And so it's kind of a situation like I think we've seen before, particularly with the emergence of smartphones, where people will trade their privacy for convenience. I think we're going to continue to see that deal being made.
Let's go back to the phones. We've got Andrew on the line in St. Paul. Andrew, thanks for joining the conversation.
Oh, thanks for taking my call. You can hear me. I'm just in a hallway.
Yes.
When you had a said you had a cyborg anthropologist, I definitely had to stop and listen. So my question is for her. I studied anthropology in school. But specifically on the, I think, the importance of tactile, buttons and such, and the example being I was just in my car, and I still have a 2004 car with dials that you turn by hand, and my girlfriend just got a brand-new car with a touchscreen. And I've noticed right away that I much prefer the actual knobs that you I know when I turn it all the way to the right, for instance, I'm at the defrost, for instance. And the screen is actually much harder because you have to actually look at it and touch it. And so I just wanted her to comment on, am I just being a Luddite, or is there something really of value that it's actually like I can still look at the road and, turn my dials because my hands can kind of do the walking, so to speak.
Great question, Andrew. Yeah, thank you for that. Amber, you want to take that on? So does our brain work differently if we're using a visual tactile interface versus a voice interface?
Sure, that's a great question. Thank you so much. This is something I argue for a lot with companies because they'll say, well, let's just make a flat interface for everything. And I say, have you ever tried to drive a car and your primary attention's on the road and then you've got a touchscreen three layers deep and you just want to turn up and down the volume? And they say, oh, no, we haven't tested it in the field. And I say, are you kidding me? Do you understand that they're like the whole idea of tactile is so that you don't have to look? Your brain is it's very easy to memorize things. Like, for instance, you walk into a dark room and there's a light switch and you turn on the light switch. You tap on the wall until you find the light switch and then you turn it on. It's pretty standardized. But if you have a house full of Hue light bulbs and you can't turn on and off the lights until you look at your smartphone and then your smartphone is out of battery, so you have to plug it in just to turn on and off the lights, how useful is that? I mean, the whole point of tactile interfaces is so that you can do more things because you have more channels of communication with your technology. I was talking with a connected speaker company about this, and they said, should we do this thing where it's just on your phone, or should we have tactile buttons? And I said, how about this? You're in your living room and you're really cozy and you want to change the preset on the radio or whatever. And now you have to go through your app and then you see all of these text messages and all this interference and you just want to change the preset. And we argued about it because the whole idea is that why do you need to go through this weird liquid interface to do something? I mean, we should have the standard things that you need every day, which are the defrost button, that are based on personal safety in a car. They should always be physical. And then some of the other buttons, if you want, if you have Bluetooth or something like that, sure, you can connect that. But tactile is really, really important. And I think we're learning that as we get these slick interfaces that are kind of liquid, where the buttons can be anywhere, we miss that touch. And if you look at any professional space or any factory, the buttons that are there are oftentimes physical for a reason, because you need to know where they are and people remember where they are. So it's really important cognitively to have physical buttons. Thanks for the question.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting. A while back this past summer, we had the whole Pokemon Go craze start up, in which people were using their handheld phones. And suddenly, people who were gamers who said they were couch potatoes, they said, I'm out walking maybe 10, 20 miles a day right now because of this game that's gotten me engaged in my physical world. And I'm wondering if there is an avenue here with these sorts of technologies around health and well-being that can we change human behavior that way and a way that's sustainable to get people up and moving, perhaps in a way that they haven't been before? Amber?
Sure. Yeah. I mean, it's the great thing about Pokemon Go is that for an enterprise that was, how many years old? 20, 30 years old, mm-hmm. Attached to your phone, just gave everybody the ability to be a Pokemon trainer again and go and explore their world in a way that they didn't do it before. But if you look at the original game Ingress, the programmers, especially the head of the company, didn't really support the players in the way that they could have, so they didn't set up any upgrades. And for people in the city where there was lots of Pokemon, it was great, but people in rural places didn't get as many Pokemon, so they were disadvantaged. Mm-hmm. There were all sorts of issues with that game. There's definitely, Pokemon Go could have been much better than it was if there was a lot more support given to requests from people and things started to get fixed in the way that people requested. And so I think if people make some sort of game like that, or there's so many opportunities, but if you do it, listen to your audience and actually implement what they're asking instead of saying, oh, no, well, I don't want to do this. I mean, there were so many posts on Reddit where like the head of Pokemon Go was like, well, we're not going to do this because I don't believe in it, or something mm-hmm. like that, you know. So they just lost all this opportunity. And right. the other thing is that game made so much money because it got people out, and it got I remember in like it was kind of like a micro singularity for, you know, a couple weeks. You could talk to anybody on the street, you know,
exactly.
old or young, no matter who they were, because they were all in the same reality.
They were all hanging out in parks and going on hunts for the same
yeah.
creatures. Ben Sauer, you know, I'm curious when you look at this, I've heard talk of the potential for these devices to be used to care for the elderly, to keep them in their homes longer. I'm wondering if there are avenues here that are sort of the next wave or the next vision for these personal, you know, software programs, devices in their homes.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, you spoke about health there and the potential for technology. I think we tend to kind of put lots of new technologies into the heaven or hell box.
Mm.
And I think that's kind of not the way it tends to happen. It tends to be somewhere in the middle, some negative, some positive, and we're constantly navigating our way through the negatives and the positives as the change of technology speeds up. I do think the cases you just mentioned there in terms of people living at home are particularly applicable to voice, because actually I think there's some research that shows that the time at which people need to leave their own homes and go into care is actually limited. It tends to happen when a few small physical tasks tend to get difficult, things like changing a light bulb or, you know, switching things on and off in your home. And actually, if technology or some external help can help with those tasks, people can actually stay at home and be relatively self-sufficient far longer. So I do think that is a very interesting case for voice.
You know, we did have somebody call in earlier during the hour to let us know that they work in the military, and that when with fighter pilots on planes, if they lose consciousness, a female voice actually revives them faster than a male voice, they said. So there's a reason there for having a female voice, at least in those military situations, that they get a faster response time than a male voice. Fascinating. As we wind up the hour, I'm curious, Ben, what are you excited for, the next big thing? We've just got a minute left here, but is there a particular product or aspect of these devices that you're excited about?
I suppose it's what I wouldn't say excited. I am curious as to what happens when these things are truly ubiquitous. So Amazon have basically shifted their strategy a little bit to actually let anybody embed Alexa, the voice assistant, into their devices. So we're now going to see, you know, TVs, fridges, alarm clocks have this voice assistant in them, perhaps by default. You know, you might buy a device and not even know it has it in it. So what happens when this stuff is just everywhere in your home and work? I mean, I really don't know. I'm excited to find out.
Okay. You might be excited. I'm a little nervous, but we'll see what happens.
Me too. Yeah, both. Yeah.
Thanks so much to both of you for joining us this hour. It's been a fascinating conversation. We've been talking with Ben Sauer. He's a digital product designer and strategist at Clear Left. And Amber Case. She's a cyborg anthropologist and the author of Calm Technology and An Illustrated Dictionary of Cyborg Anthology. You're listening to NPR News.